Welcome back to the Renaissance Foundation podcast, a podcast about inspiration made by the young people at our youth charity. We work to transform the lives of young carers and hospital patients in London by inspiring them to achieve their full potential. I'm Corey, a member of staff at Renaissance Foundation, and I intro and edit the podcasts. We took a little break from posting so we could focus on our outreach program and fundraising. We've been doing some really fun workshops, including baking cupcakes on Zoom with our young leaders, arts and crafts, financial literacy with HSBC, nature photography and editing tips, and careers in law insight with Middle Temple Young Barristers Association and Miles and Partners Law Firm. So lots of fun stuff going on at RF, which has been a pleasure to organise and be part of. We are super excited to share our episode today with Ben Rhodes, former Deputy National Security Advisor and speechwriter for President Obama. We spoke to Ben Rhodes in episode 8, wow, back in the first lockdown in May 2020. And we were so inspired by his chat, we invited him back to record an episode live on Zoom with our donors and supporters watching. Thank you, Ben, for coming back to speak and inspiring us. Thank you to RF graduate Siddiqa for doing an absolutely amazing job hosting the talk. So professional, we couldn't be more proud. Thank you to all RF young leaders that joined. And those of you that submitted such great questions, you all made this event extra special by taking part. This event was organised in celebration of our Champions for Children campaign. We're so grateful to everyone who donated and helped us smash our target. In particular, the Childhood Trust, the Rumi Foundation, Penn, and all those who wish to remain anonymous. It's a long road to recovery for our young people, and this is just the start. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a monthly donor to support Renaissance Foundation. Head over to renaissance-foundation.com to find out more, and head over to our Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to see more inspirational content. Now, I'll hand over to our CEO and founder, Sat Singh, who will be introducing our talk today.
So hi, everyone. Thanks for kindly making time to join us this evening. We're really excited to hear from Ben and hear all the questions that everyone has from him as well. I wanted to first say thank you so much to everyone for kindly making time to join us and also for Ben for kindly making time to dial in from the States. It's quite exciting because Ben's latest book only got released a few weeks ago. So it is very, very topical since we just had the G7 summit as well with the new president. So things are, I think, politics on everybody's mind at the moment. And fitting in with the theme of inspiration for young people, which is what Renaissance Foundation is all about, you can't think of a better person than Ben, who started his career as a young person, as an outsider from politics, and then was able to be part of the President Obama's sort of campaign and then two White House administrations. So with that in mind, I wanted to introduce everyone also to Siddiqa, who's going to be hosting today's session. Siddiqa's been an amazing graduate of the RF program and also has been to the Nobel Peace Prize with Renaissance Foundation. And I think he also was at the town hall with President Obama as well. So, we're really excited to have you to interview Ben this year, like you did last year. And thanks, Ben, kindly joining us. Really nice to see you. So thank you for making time to speak to us again at Renaissance Foundation. We know how busy you are with your latest book that came out a few weeks ago. So thank you so much for making time to speak with the young people from Renaissance Foundation again. It's really appreciated.
Happy to do it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's a bit crazy because of the book and the Biden trip, which, creates a lot of media, but I'm really glad to spend some time with you guys. It's probably be my most enjoyable 30 minutes of the day.
Thank you so much. Siddiqa, I'll hand over to you for this.
Cool. Hi, Ben. My name's Siddiqa. It's great to have you on today. And it's nice to see you face to face this time. I think last time we were just on a phone call.
That's right.
I just wanted to say, to introduce myself. I've been with RF for over 6 years now. Last time I asked a question about how you dealt with stress. Something you said was about the importance of family and reading. And I think you quoted, if you lose track of them, you lose track of yourself, which was like an eye-opening thing that you just said. So yeah, I just wanted to get an update about like what you've been doing and yeah, how's it going?
Well, I think that, look, the pandemic was hard everywhere and created different types of stress, obviously, than we've accustomed to experiencing. And, you know, I spent most of it, I'm used to traveling a lot. And this is the first time in, 15 years that I was really just in one place for over a year. And like everybody else in lockdown with my family, which is a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old and my wife, and I was working on this book and that was difficult. You know, we have kind of a small house and I was working in a storage attic, like not a place that you're supposed to be, working. It's a place that you put, old stuff. I think it was incredibly disorienting. And so you have hard times and you don't want to acknowledge, some of your worst fears too. When there were particular spikes, that sense of danger around yourself and your family and your community. I think for me, in terms of how I dealt with that, I think it did kind of force me to wrestle with like, well, what really matters to me and what do I really care about? And can I carve out time? I mean, we could still walk here because it's not an intensely urban environment. So, every day I just take a walk with my daughters, and the simple things took more meaning, like a meal together, a walk together, a sense of satisfaction if I did some work, but letting myself off the hook if I didn't, I'm not saying I hit that balance perfectly, but I found that like I felt more strangely centered, about halfway through COVID than I had been in a long time, because you kind of, in a period of trauma, which we'll obviously all have to work through, the one thing you can do is identify like what matters more than the other things. What do I really need to stress about? And what is frankly not so important? That was kind of my experience in miniature.
Well, thanks for that, Ben. I just like to ask one question as we start off. So how did you find the process of writing a book in lockdown during COVID? Were there any moments when you lost motivation or inspiration?
So, yeah, I mean, and some of you guys may have seen this book. It was a challenging book because it was kind of about things that are not necessarily going right around the world. And, there are a couple ways I kept motivation. I mean, I'd set out to write about why this politics seem to be moving in the wrong direction everywhere, why this rise of anti-democratic kind of nationalism and authoritarianism. And, one of the things that was challenging is that I was talking to Alexei Navalny, right? A Russian who was subsequently poisoned and he's now in prison in Russia. I was talking to Hong Kong protesters and just young people in Hong Kong too, who were kind of dealing with their city being kind of taken away from them. And that, on the one hand was difficult to interact with. On the other hand, though, you're watching these other people take much greater risks than I ever have to. And similarly, like to me, it kind of bottomed out. I was really kind of at the peak of working on this book right when the Black Lives Matter movement happened here. And that was also kind of a bit of a low point in the pandemic, too, in the sense that by that point, it was pretty clear that our government was just not going to get its arms around this, that whatever the worst case scenario was pretty much going to happen here. And the lockdowns were going to be kind of open-ended for at least a year. And then you have this, the George Floyd killing, Breonna Taylor. And I remember, just being really kind of angry, which, in a way I never really been, because I'm walking with my daughters in the street and I'm already dealing with a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. I have to wear a mask and stay away from other people. Then there's murals of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor everywhere, and I'm having to explain to them, at such a young age, what it means that white people killed black people in violent ways like this. And then there were Army National Guard posted on our street, I think unnecessarily. And so then I'm having to explain why the Army is literally on our street. I mean, so it felt, and I had to say, as an American, but as an American who's worked on global issues, it felt like I was experiencing a small part of like what is not that uncommon around the world, which is like just a basically a failed government and the darker places that can lead. But then I remember that there was a protest in my street and I joined it, and I was totally anonymous, walking in the crowd with a mask like everybody else, socially distanced crowd, very orderly, but very focused and committed, very diverse crowd. And in keeping with that movement, everybody kind of kneels and then there's speeches given and there are moments of silence for George Floyd. And sitting there, part of that collective, particularly with people who had a lot more reason to be angry than me, Black and Brown Americans, I felt incredibly hopeful in the sense that, first of all, here are people that still care enough to come out and protest. Again, who have reason to think that things are never going to change, but then also the sense of collective, like, no, they're good people. Like the world can conspire to make you believe that it's full of bad people. And there are unfortunately bad people in power in certain places, but I still believe most people are fundamentally decent people and want to be a part of a collective that tries to make things better. And so that got me through that particularly difficult moment of both writing a book and COVID and processing all these kind of somewhat traumatic experiences that were happening around.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on that as well. It's like during that moment, I just remember everyone bringing like collective action, and social media really played a big part in raising awareness. So yeah, it was really great that everyone was taking part into it as well.
And people want to be, I think for younger people, they want to also feel connected to one another, young people around. There's lots to criticize about social media, but one of the positives is that young people can feel a part of like a bigger collective and a bigger movement and a bigger set of kind of a community of people who have common values around the world. That's important. I mean, that's worth doing because it is a way to remind yourself that you're not alone with what you're feeling. You're not alone with your anger or your fears or your hopes. There's a lot of people out there who share that.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you said. I'll just move on to our second question. So your first book, The World As It is a reflection of an incredible moment in your journey. What advice would you have for young people beginning their journey, especially those who want to make a change in the world?
I think that like the biggest piece of advice I would give is like to focus on doing something that feels natural to you. And what do I mean by that? I think sometimes people who want to make change in the world, in America in particular, so I can't, I encounter this a lot in America. They think of it as a kind of a resume accumulation process, I should get this internship and then this, need to go to this school and this job, and they forget why they're trying to change the world. And by the way, when I say something that feels naturally, the reason I put it that way is that can be that you are working on an issue that you're really passionate about. And that issue like can be, something you can work on in politics, at an NGO, in academia, there are lots of ways. If you care about climate change, or you care about hunger, or you care about homelessness, or you care about whatever the issue is, keep in mind there's a lot of avenues. So it's not just going into public service. That's one great way to do it. You can write about something, you can study something, you can be an activist on something. There are these different pathways. But I also say come naturally, because it can also be like, is there a skill that you particularly have? For me, it was writing. That's what came natural to me. That's the way I interacted with foreign policy, was writing about it, and then writing speeches about it. And then that led me into politics as a speechwriter and kind of storyteller, really, working for President Obama at the time. So the reason I say this is because you'll enjoy your work better and you'll be better at it, I think, if it's either an issue you care about or a particular skill you have. That as you get older, you'll end up in places that are more natural extension of your interests or your skills, if that's how you think about it. I would encourage people too, like, to these are long journeys, and I mean, don't get too frustrated that change doesn't happen at the pace you want. I mean, I've had a pretty remarkable 20 years, but I've seen stuff I really cared about that looked like it was moving in totally the right direction. Then I've seen it move completely the wrong direction, and then half step in the right direction again. And you have to kind of accept that it's the process of doing the work that is the point, not that you're ever necessarily going to achieve exactly what the change you want. I mean, we all have to do the work. If enough of us do the work, things get better. There's still going to be things that aren't fixed, right? And that too is something I had to learn over time. That sense of young people are rightly impatient, and impatience is what changes the world. But don't be so impatient that you don't accept progress, even if progress doesn't get everything you want.
Yeah, just as you were saying, I feel like it's just the age. Everyone feels like they have to be somewhere at a certain age and they have to be doing something or, you know, be successful by 25. But it's like everyone's different and everyone takes their steps as it goes. And so many people have taken so many years to get to where they are. So don't rush. Like, take your time. You're on your own journey, just like you said. So yeah.
There's no rush. There's no rush. Yeah. And as someone who got places faster than I thought, like, well, the downside of that is, like, I'm 43 and what to figure out what I can do the rest of my life. Like, I mean, there's no exact way to do this. Yeah. I mean, Joe Biden's 78 and just got elected president probably, you know, like 30 years after he first ran for president. I know people who worked for Joe Biden who probably had given up on ever being in those positions. And now here they are, like, you. So like, the journey is at a different pace for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd like to ask a second question. So a young person called Demi, who's 16, asked, how did you decide what to include and what to leave out of your books? What boundaries did you have to consider?
So I think in this in this last book, After the Fall, I considered boundaries of, you know, if you do read it, and even if you don't, like, it's pretty critical of a lot of things about American foreign policy, domestic policy, America kind of itself. Albeit, I think, also hopeful and about the things that I love about America, but. I realized in writing it, like, well, if I say it this way, you know, I'm probably, and I say this in the book, I'm probably not going to be invited back in the government. You know, like, there's a kind of a decorum in American politics. Even now, it's obviously, there's no decorum on the right of American politics, but on the left, you know, if you want to get confirmed by the U.S. Senate to some big government job, like, you probably don't want a track record of saying some of the things that I say in my book, for instance, about Republicans in particular. And you already saw, you know, there's been, I know someone near attendant who was unable to be confirmed to a big job because she tweeted some mean things about Republicans, which is pretty amazing to think about after 4 years of Trump. But I made a kind of a decision, like, I'm not going to put those boundaries around me. I'd rather say what I think with no self-censorship. And also, I kind of did that in a way because I'm writing a book about authoritarianism, and authoritarianism relies heavily on self-censorship. I mean, those systems kind of depend on people kind of agreeing to not call things what they are at times. And so the biggest boundary I had to kind of break was was that, the kind of psychological, which I honestly don't know that I fully did in my first book. This book feels more, in way, more personal and raw. In the first book, it's not that I wasn't being honest. It's that I still had the voice of a government official in my head, you know, where you're a spokesperson and you're kind of being careful in your words. So that was the biggest boundary I had to break, was just like, this is what I think, you know, if it gets me in trouble with some people, so be it. I don't need to go back into government right away. Maybe someday I will, but like my role in the world, as I've kind of processed it now, is not that I'm that important, but just for myself is to just be someone who says what I think. And insofar as I think I have any connection to people through my podcast or my writing or whatever else I do, I think it's because people think I'm actually telling them what, you know, so many people who work in things like foreign policy seem to speak in some weird jargon language that doesn't make any sense to people. Right. So that was the boundary I had to break, and accepting that, you know, it was going to be kind of hard to watch all these great friends of mine go back into the Biden administration. And, but I just, that's the time of my life I'm in. I did eight years of that. And this feels more like authentic to what I want to be doing right now. I think in terms of what I left out, I think that, you know, for me, the main challenge for this book is, I unfortunately could have written about a lot of places, you know, if you're writing about the rise of nationalism and authoritarianism. So to me, it was having to figure out how to be selective about the people whose stories I'm telling, and finding enough. The book had to work as like a cohesive, you know, the structure was difficult. I talk about Hungary and Russia and China and the US, and obviously I could talk about Brazil and India and Turkey and, you know, and you know, Israel and the, you know, Saudi Arabia. I mean, I had to kind of like, this is about making the transition of being maybe not an artist, but like a creator. Like you have to have that, the willingness to break boundaries and be honest and authentic, like I was saying, but you also have to have the discipline to say like, I can't take everything on, you know, like I can only accomplish so much here. I need to put some structure around what I'm doing, a set of characters and a set of places to tell a story that holds together. And so that was actually quite a big challenge for me, is just finding, how do I tell enough that I'm like communicating what I want to get across without biting off more than I can chew, to use the phrase.
Just from hearing that snippet is making me really excited to read your book. Apologies, I haven't read it yet, but I will.
That's okay.
So another young person just wanted to ask, called Humaira, who's age 12. Do you prefer writing books or speeches, and why?
That's a really good question. And I guess I'm going to kind of duck it a little bit, in the sense that I prefer writing books. Like a book, I like the length of a book. I like the idea that you can really follow. What I liked about it is, here's how I put it. Like, the book I ended up writing is not the book I set out to write. You know, which is, and I mean that in a good way. Like, I discovered things that I didn't know I was going to discover. Things happen that I didn't expect to happen. And a book allows you the length to unpack that. And also, obviously, like, a book is my own voice. And so it's kind of finding out, you know, I believe that you kind of write to find out what you think about things. Like, writing definitely does that for me. On the other hand, so like, in terms of just writing speeches versus writing books, like, writing books is more enjoyable. On the other hand, like, I will never have another experience quite like writing certain speeches for President Obama, because, you know, if this book is like, succeeds beyond my, you know, wildest ambitions, you know, a few hundred thousand people might read it. And that's a lot. I mean, that's like a huge, you know, that's if everything goes perfectly. I mean, if Barack, the Cairo speech, I don't know how many people watched that, you know, like his Nobel Peace speech, his, you know, like, I could, you know, there's a handful of speeches that he gave on the world stage, Nelson Mandela's, you know, eulogy, that stand out in my memory as these kind of moments where you're working on something that is going to kind of enter directly into not just politics, but kind of culture out there in the world. And I loved to think, and I still love to think about, particularly when people say, well, you must be disappointed that this speech didn't, you know, the world didn't change the way you wanted. To me, it's kind of like what I was saying earlier. The exciting thing about the all to that is, yeah, but I don't know what all the people who were who listened to that speech or heard it or read it, like, what are they doing with their lives? Like, what there was some tiny little impact that something President Obama said had on people that might have led them to enter politics. Or, you know, as I met people who like told me they decided to run for office because they heard him do a speech, or they decided to move back home and start a civil society organization. So to me, like, the exciting thing about those bigger Obama speeches was the way in which they just interacted with a lot of people around the world in ways that like no book I write ever could. So again, even though I enjoy like just the form of writing books more, like I will, you know, probably never have like the experience of knowing, you know, there were probably like 10 to 15 Obama speeches that I worked on where you're like, okay, this thing, you know, is going to take on a life so far beyond me. And that, you know, that's, it's almost strange to think that I had that experience, you know? But yeah, that was probably the best writing experience I could ask for, because you can't ask for anything more than an audience. Right. And again, it wasn't just speech writing, it was speech writing for Barack Obama. Like, I don't, as much as I love, say, Joe Biden, like, I don't think like there'll be he's not a speech guy. Like, that's not the vehicle through which he principally engages the world, you know, as much as it was for Obama. So I had this kind of unique opportunity that I was aware at the time it was a unique opportunity.
Yeah, it's just crazy and how like the opportunity that you were able to get, and, you know, to make a speech for Barack Obama again, it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
As always. We have another question, but unfortunately we only have time for one from the audience this time. So let me see. So by Nia McDonough, how and where did you gain the courage to perform a speech in front of Obama?
So for me, myself, to like, you know, it's interesting. I used to be like very nervous about any kind of public speaking, which sounds insane now, given that my life is kind of public speaking, you know, going on television or writing and then going out and talking about it. But I used to be nervous. I was terrified to do any media. And I actually didn't really do much, even the first few years I was in the White House. I was terrified even to speak in some meetings in front of, you know, the first few meetings I was in with, say, Barack Obama. Like, I was nervous to speak out loud. And I was nervous to, like, give a speech in front of an audience, like every, you know, like probably a lot of you are. And I didn't really, I guess the two things that got me through that, like, one is you just have to push through it. I mean, there's not really another, you know, I had to let myself kind of not do that well a couple of times, you know? I remember the first time I had to kind of stand up and give a press conference, I was terrified, and it showed. Like, it was as bad as I felt in the moment. Like, I looked at the camera and I was like, boom, and that guy looks nervous. But you know what? Like, the world didn't end. Like, to you, it seems like the world ends. Like, nobody else is thinking as much about you as you are thinking about yourself. And it's like, well, I'll just, the next time I won't be as nervous. And that's kind of what like, there's just, you know, so part of it is that perspective of like, so what, you're a little nervous. Like, people know what that means. And anybody who's going to be a jerk about that is just like not the kind of person you should care that much about anyway. Right. But then the second trick, so once I got a little bit comfortable, the second trick that really opened up space for me to be much more comfortable making arguments in meetings or standing up and speaking publicly, is like, then I started to tell myself, well, why not try to enjoy it? like we always think about it. Like, if you ever have to do public speaking, like, you're kind of training yourself. you're trying to trick yourself into not being terrified. I kind of tried to turn that upside down and say, well, wait a second, like, why shouldn't this be like, why shouldn't I think this is a great opportunity? I get to stand up and tell people what I think, or I get to make an argument in a room in front of the President of the United States. Like I should actually remember to enjoy this as a huge opportunity that not a lot of people get, you know? And that totally transformed this whole kind of question from one of like, how do I avoid being terrified and appearing terrified, to wait, I want to do this. Cause like, how many chances will I get to do this? You know? And again, that's hard to start there. I think sometimes you just have to kind of fight through your fears at first, but like, if you can get to that point where you're able to remind yourself, like, and it applies to anything in life. I told a bunch of the people that went into the Biden administration, when my last piece of advice to each of them was, hey, remember to have some fun while you're there. Like, the jobs are hard, they're stressful, but like, they can also be fun if you let yourself enjoy doing the work, you know? So I think that's something we can all remind ourselves sometimes, is like, you know, all these things are not, whether it's like your studies, your work, a job, like, we forget in this day and age to like actually enjoy those things instead of just seeing them as sources of stress.
Just as you were talking about that, this just reminds me of what I'm doing right now. And I just took this webinar as something that I should just enjoy as well. Like, just speaking to you, just like a normal conversation. And like you said, yeah, I've growing up as well, I've had so many chances to speak in front of a public audience, and I've always been so nervous to the core with my legs shaking. But every time it's just like, I've got this opportunity, let's just do it and go for it. So just take it as it is. So yeah, that's great.
But then, you know, at the end, you kind of, then sometimes at the end, you start to relax. And then when it's over, you almost like are upset it's
over. I
want to
do it again.
Yeah, you want to do it again. And at a certain point, you have to tell yourself, like, remember how you feel at the end, that like, you want to keep going, you want to do more, like, cause why not start there? And you know, again, it's hard to get there. I don't want to suggest this is like a light switch. It took me, you know, a period of years, I think, to get to that mentality, but that is, I think, the mentality to shoot for.
Yes. And on that note, I'd just like to thank you for having you on with us. It was great speaking to you. And I wanted to say good luck on your book tour. I really wish that I could speak to you for longer because we have so many questions, but unfortunately not today. I'd just like to hand it over to our RF Director of Fundraising and Impact, Natalie Shevin. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Sadiqa. Thanks, Ben. Ben, thank you. Inspiring, yeah. Brilliant. I loved what you said about most people like being part of a collective, and we're an amazing collective here at Renaissance Foundation. Our young people, our guests, our inspirational speakers, all joined together to create a wonderful experience for our young people. And you are, again, gracing us. Maybe we can make this annual. It's been twice in 2 years.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, and I hopefully get back to the UK. But I've been really impressed by the kind of community building and focus on young people. So to those of you who are supporting it, I encourage you to, I mean, I can't think of anything more important in this day and age than just investing in young people, because that's the only true solution to our problems. So thank you to everybody participating. Thank you, everybody supports a great foundation.
Thank you, Ben. That means a lot. Thank you. This event was obviously meant to be part of our Champions for Children fundraising campaign, which was to raise £100,000 for RF. I'm pleased to tell you we actually smashed our total last week, which is absolutely incredible. Absolutely thrilled. We would like to thank our donors, some of whom are on the chat tonight. Particular thanks to the Penn Foundation, the Rumi Foundation, the Childhood Trust, all our donors that wish to remain anonymous, but everybody that's made a difference, because that is a significant amount of funding for our young people. You can still support RF. There's going to be a link in the chat to become a monthly donor. It costs around £300,000 every year to keep RF going and providing amazing experiences like this for our young people. So I think if you're a guest tonight, hopefully you've got a little bit of the flavour of what we do. And for RF, it's all about the inspiration. Sadiqa, our huge, amazing thanks to you for hosting a fantastic interview. you. Smooth as you like, no nerves on show. You are such a credit to yourself and to RF, and we're so thrilled that you could host tonight. Heartfelt thanks to you. But yeah, finally, thank you to all our guests, our panelists, our young people from RF who have submitted some brilliant questions. We had such a hard time trying to decide which to ask. And yes, the link to Ben's book, which we have started actually reading in our Audible book club, absolutely fascinating so far. The link is in the chat, and also the link to becoming a monthly donor. But on behalf of Sat, the young people, Sadiqa, I hope you agree that was an absolutely fascinating half hour with someone who's been at the heart of the Obama administration, and what an interesting journey he's had. But our grateful thanks for joining this evening and for helping to make this event such a great success. And we hope to see you all very soon. Thank you.